Today's first speaker is Lee Daniels. Dr. Daniels is a professor of environmental soil science at Virginia Tech University in Blacksburg, Virginia. He received his PhD in soil geomorphology from VPI and SU in 1985. His areas of specialization include stabilization and restoration of disturbed lands, particularly areas disturbed by mining, road building, waste disposal, and urbanization. In particular, he has focused his research and consulting experience in mine reclamation, waste remediation, and wetland impact mitigation. His teaching programs at Virginia Tech focus on soil geomorphology and landscape analysis with particular emphasis on the relationships among superficial geology, hydrology, soil patterns, and long-term landscape evolution processes. Dr. Daniels, or Lee, I'll turn things over to you now.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lee Daniels. I'm sitting in my office at Virginia Tech. It's a beautiful day here, but things are awfully quiet. We had our last day of classes today, and as you might expect, we didn't have a whole lot of folks here. I do want to say, before I get started, we deeply appreciate all the letters, emails, and the measures of support we've gotten over the past 2 weeks, literally from all countries and from all states, and we do appreciate that. Also want to point out on the first slide here that as we move through that website listed at the bottom of the first page there is our research and outreach website. There is quite a bit of content and detail on each of the topics I'll be covering here on that website if you want to follow up there. The second slide then gives an overview of the materials I'll be covering. The first third or so of the presentation, we're just going to talk about site disturbance in general, make sure we're all on the same page in terms of terminology, and talk about soil functions. I'll then switch gears a little bit towards the middle of the presentation and talk about the chemical and physical properties of these waste and reconstructed soils, as I call them, and then we'll finish up looking at a range of case studies. I think to put this all in context, it's important to understand that in North America and over a longer period of time in Europe and on other continents, we've had a sequence, if you wish, of increasing disturbance to our landscape. And that started with land clearing and erosion. We've had surface mining since the 1800s. We've had urbanization effects. We've had road building impacts. We've had utility impacts. The net result of this cumulatively across the country is that we increasingly deal with landscapes and soil bodies that have been essentially completely removed from the system and turned upside down. On slide four here, we see a modern contour coal mine. Now, much of the technology that I'll be talking about today and most of the research really chains back to coal mining research originally in the 60s and 70s and 80s that has been expanded outward to other systems since that time. When the Surface Mining Reclamation Act, though, passed in the late 1970s, it caused a boom, really, in very site-specific focused research dealing with a wide range of landscape reclamation and, say, rehabilitation processes and studies. On slide five here, we can see the reason for that, and that's that there's, you know, just very wide parts of the country that are mined for coal, and there's intensive impacts both in the central basins, the western coal fields, and of course historically in the east in the Appalachians. On slide six, I've got a picture here of coal processing waste, and the point that I want to make with this is particularly when we deal with mining impacts and mining impacted landscapes that, in my opinion, more often than not, dealing with the mine site itself is much less daunting than dealing with the processing waste. And coal waste is no example. For every ton of eastern coal mined, we typically generate at least a half a ton of acid-forming coal waste, and they're often put in these very large coal waste piles. Similarly, on slide seven here, we can see an example from the western states where certainly we have on-site mining impacts, but oftentimes it's the tailings areas or the processing waste associated with the given mining operations that often really pose the daunting challenges. And we'll come back later on and talk about these aspects. Similarly, just simple things like building roads. In the east, we have a lot of sulfidic acid-forming materials that have nothing to do with mining impacts that are turned up by road building and airport to construction. And we now in, for example, Virginia alone have over 100 documented locations where there have been severe impacts just by digging down in the earth deep enough that I exposed these sulfidic sediments like you see in PowerPoint slide 8 here, and with drastic both on-site and off-site issues. Sounds like we've got something on the background here.
Yeah, again, this is Jean. If you haven't done so already, you can mute your phone lines by pressing star 6.
That sounded like elevator music there, but anyway. Okay, so we're up on slide 9 now, and in terms of the terminology we commonly use, I'll just put up a couple terms here, and I will use them almost interchangeably throughout my talk, and that's really a bad habit, but I just want to point out that depending on where you are and what your focus are looking at a disturbed landscape, we often call similar approaches very different things. The term reclamation has been used in this country, particularly for the stabilization and the revegetation of almost all mined lands. However, it's important to point out that that term reclamation, particularly in the western states, also applies to essentially taking salty soils, draining them, and actually converting them to a cropping system. Restoration is a term often used a lot, and I think often misused. Restoration, I think, should be used only in its narrowest sense, where you're trying to actually restore a site back to its pre-disturbance conditions, if possible, to the exact, I shouldn't say exact, but at least to a similar system in terms of soil conditions and vegetative conditions. Revegetation is a term that gets used really broadly, and that's really any time I'm putting any sort of vegetation on any site. Revegetation tends to be the term of choice used in particularly subdivision urban uses and particularly in the highway development process. I think the term that probably may be the best fit, and it's the one that's currently in vogue by the Aussies and the Brits and the Europeans these days, would be rehabilitation. This has a broader context and meaning, but you can call almost anything we do out there rehabilitation as long as I'm moving the system into a more productive and safe land use, particularly with the respect to soil quality and to water quality effects. And that you don't have to use it specifically like you do with restoration only, particularly where a final target is involved. Finally, a couple R words here. Two more here on slide 11. One is remediation, of course, and I think a lot of you in the seminar today deal with this. But in dealing with the Superfund and the Brownfields folks recently, it now appears that the term revitalization has been used, and that would be the fifth R word. And that really clearly separates it from the use of the terms like restoration and reclamation. Slide 12, then, let's flip back and look at a nice intact soil. This is a beautiful prairie soil from Iowa. And again, I think it's very important. The focus of what I'll be talking about mostly today is how do we move towards recreating productive and high-quality soils on these sites. And obviously, this is a beautiful soil with very high levels of productivity for a number of reasons I'll be talking about shortly. Beyond that, though, we need to talk about what are the important functions, though, that once I get a soil recreated on a given site, I'm expecting it to actually perform. Slide 13 shows a short list of some important things we would want any soil in any setting to hopefully provide to both the vegetative community, the in-soil biota, and its overall watershed water quality linkages. First of all, the soil we build out there has got to be capable of physically supporting the whatever vegetation we put out there. This is particularly important with woody trees. A lot of times if the soil is too shallow, it just can't hold trees up. Ventilation, gas exchange, aeration is critically important. Different species of plants are adapted to different sorts of gas exchange environments, and we need to make sure that if the plant species I want to reestablish need a well-oxygenated environment, that we can physically and chemically recreate that. The soil also is very important in terms of temperature moderation. If I put a thermistor down in soil at just a couple inches, during the summer, it's going to be tremendously cooler at that depth, and during the winter, it's going to be much warmer at that depth. So the soil has a really important temperature buffering effect with time. Water holding is obvious, and water holding is directly related to things like texture and rock content and rooting depth I'll be talking about. There's also a whole host of secondary and tertiary products, mainly organics, that are generated as organic matter breaks down that are very important in actually protecting both the higher plants and certain members of the microbial biomass against pathogens. And finally, the combination of appropriate chemical conditions and organic matter content is very important in terms of buffering or decreasing soil acidity, tying up or decreasing the phytotoxicity of certain metals, and then overall nutrient supply we'll actually talk about later on. On slide 14, then, I've got a picture here of a native forest soil. And again, just as a good example, this, in fact, is a virgin forest soil that's never been logged, and it's in western North Carolina. It's got tremendous amounts of humus accumulating in it. The important thing is in its native state. This soil is a natural bioprocessor of added litter every year. It's being chewed upon. It's being decomposed. Minerals are being liberated out of it. The soil is deep. It's well drained. It's offering physical support. It is offering all the benefits I just talked about. And the important thing is we need to think about what the soil supplies to the plant community and the biotic complex as a much broader set of functions and supporting mechanisms than just nutrition. When we only focus on liming and nutrition in terms of soil reconstruction, a lot of times we just simply, I would say, miss the boat in terms of our targeting out there. Figure 15 is a simple pH scale. I think most of you are familiar with it. I'll be talking about effects of pH later on. The typical pH range in our native soils in the east is between 5 and 7, and then between 7 and 9. Anytime the soil pH gets out of this range, the 5 to say 8.5 range, either to the low end or the high end above 9, we routinely see major problems, and in fact we have real problems finding any adapted species in those ranges. And again, the important thing in terms of just interpreting pH is that it's a log 10 scale. So, for example, we commonly see pH 4 soils out there. Well, pH 4 versus pH 7 is actually 10 to the 3 times more acid. So it's 1,000 times more acid. And so even minor changes in pH at certain sites can have a dramatic effect on the net, say, phytotoxicity of those soils. And that's why we spend an awful lot of time trying to isolate and focus on acid-forming materials, and then how we lime them. On 16, I've got another picture of a native forest soil. This a particular one is in a Pocosin wetland in eastern Virginia. Now, pH and plant growth interactions are quite interesting in that natural soils and even reconstructed soils have certain internal mechanisms to offset these acid toxic effects. And particularly, we know a soil, say, at pH 5.3, that in the absence of organic matter or calcium would definitely be root toxic, that just by having an adequate amount of humus in soil and some calcium cycling occurring in it, that directly offsets the major pH-related phytotoxicity in these systems, which is aluminum toxicity. So a lot of times, pH per se is not the only thing we have to worry about. Again, we need to look at how we manage the whole system, and there are certain things we can add, for example, to these soils that will further aid in their reconstruction and their long-term viability on sites. Slide 17, then, will move into some summary material that working on a lot of sites that I've found, and in fact, a lot of folks have found are the basic screening criteria that when you first look at any site or any material in terms of just figuring what the heck you're going to do with it, you need to focus on. And I've got these listed as four important points, 1 through 4. One is most important. Under any circumstances, you've got to avoid sulfitic and pyritic acid forming materials. And we'll be talking a lot of more about that later on. But across sites, the number one thing that causes the major headaches would be sulfides or acid forming materials. And again, in slide 18, we see they are the active bad actor in coal mining and in coal mining waste, like you see here. When you have active pyrite oxidation, you'll see these sulfate salts and acid drainage. It's basically sulfuric acid forming and then leaching over time. In slide 19, a picture of some in-stream effects from West Virginia. On 20, then, is a summary of how we look at this. We'll talk more about this later on, but we try to estimate for these acid-forming materials, what is the potential acidity? What's the total amount of acidity that a given pyritic material is going to generate over the time you'll be managing it, and then how do I estimate that? It typically ends up being many tons of lime equivalent per acre, and it's usually based on some measure of how much pyritic sulfur is in that sample. On 21, then, we move on to the associated issue. At any time I've got pyrite oxidation and or low pHs, and low pH would be anything under 5, I'm going to have increased solubility and often acid-solubilized acid attack, release of iron, manganese, zinc, copper, lead, nickel, occasionally arsenic and moly. And this low pH is generated directly via pyrite oxidation and other naturally occurring processes in soils as well. Now, a lot of times we worry overtly about things like copper, lead, and nickel, but even in natural soils, it's important to point out that at pH 5, you will likely have often very clear phytotoxicity just from aluminum via very natural processes. 22 then shows some of the obvious effects of liming, first on corn on the left-hand side and on soybeans to the right-hand side. So if I start at pH 5, at pH 5 in most soils, be it a mine soil or a tailings or a native soil, at pH 5 I'm going to have quite a bit of free aluminum, and it's going to be phytotoxic. If I'm a legume, it's going to be extremely toxic. However, different plants, for example, corn, are capable of tolerating lower pH, and there's a lot of tolerance mechanisms. However, both of these species very clearly are really responding to adding just a little bit of lime up, say, to pH 6, and then at pH 7.5, then we see the full of plant growth, the potential expressed as I've completely suppressed all the solubility of these phytotoxic metals. So 23, we move on to the next two things you have to deal with. Once you've gotten rid of having to deal with acid-forming materials, or you've limed them heavily enough, then we've got compaction problems. And I'll show you examples of this. Compaction is actually a much more common problem worldwide than is acid-forming materials, and tends to be the major problem in mining sites, and road building sites, and urban sites, and wetland sites. Compaction is a major problem. Third problem, then, would be, of course, textures or rock contents. Now, that's going to be highly site-specific. If you're in a finer textured site, obviously not a problem, but many mining sites, many tailing sites, and often urban sites have real problems with just bulk water holding capacity, which is texture. So, slide to 24 here shows a picture of a traffic pan where you see the big C there right down there, 37 centimeters. That's a traffic pan with a bulk density of about 2. Above it is a loose zone, high pH, moderate to fertility, really no limitations in this mine spoil material above or under the sea, but here the compaction in itself, regardless of fertility, is completely root limiting. Now that being said, we also see tremendous benefits of using topsoil, and sometimes this is compaction related, but this is really more related to the water holding concepts. Usually where we can save topsoil and reapply it, not only am I putting down usually a better material in terms of its bulk water holding capacity, but it would also be typically higher in organic matter and its fertility, and also, perhaps most importantly, its viable microbial biomass. And then here's a classic example on a surface mine. It's in the east of a very rocky mine spoil on the right-hand side, and the topsoil material. Now, that's not true topsoil. That's just basically everything I could cut with the bulldozer out of the weathered zone, but that still is a much better material to be dealing with than the rocky material to the right-hand side. Fourth, if you chain down through avoiding sulfitic materials and dealing with compaction and getting as fine texture to substrate out there as possible, the fourth thing that'll come up and get you is slope aspect albedo effects. And the bottom line is the steeper the slope is, and if it's a facing south, and particularly if it's dark in color, regardless of all the other great things you do, just heat loading and water stress effects themselves can be overwhelming. And in slide 28 here, we show a picture of a coal waste pile in southern West Virginia being limed. But this is a south-facing site, and almost regardless of what sets of treatments you put on that black material, and unfortunately that lime, once it rains on it, won't be white anymore, it is very difficult to get vegetation to persist on material like this just because of heat loading effects. So then you have to get very sophisticated in figuring out how do I time my vegetation or get other materials on that surface that will lower those high summer heat loads. Finally, at slide 29, if you can chain through and deal with and hopefully eliminate as many of the four challenges I just dealt with, you can really then start thinking about, okay, what sets of amendments and practices do I need to apply on a site? Later on in this talk, I'll be talking about a wider range of soil amendments, including biosolids, waste limes, and fly ash, but I'll just point out a couple of common examples here early on. Slide 30 shows a very common amendment. Now, this is that same very rocky gray mine spoil material we just looked at a couple of pictures ago on this mining site. It's been graded out. It's extremely droughty. And then here I am land applying a mixture of biosolids plus wood chips as a water holding plus other organic amendments. I'll talk more about those benefits later on, but one of the great advantages of using organic amendments is we can almost simultaneously deal with a very wide range of soil limitations, both physical problems, chemical problems, and organic matter microbial biomass related issues. In 31, we can see here in one step at that site that with the appropriate rate and incorporation, I can basically rebuild topsoil in a single step. You'll note the subsoil there still looks pretty rough. It's a compacted and it's platy. But again, we have found that on sites like this that are essentially bare rock spoil, that some combination of organic amendment, particularly with adding lime with it, is usually the very best treatment we can use. Figure 32 here shows a different site. This is a mineral sands mining site in eastern Virginia, and just showing again a couple of alternatives we've used. In the foreground is topsoil. Again, where topsoil can be saved and returned is just beautiful stuff. However, there's lots of factors that work against saving topsoil. A lot of times you've got a site where it's just not there anymore. So a lot of work, and usually pretty effective, at adding yard waste compost and combining it with deep ripping and tillage, usually phosphorus applications plus lime. Again, and we have found that we can generate mine soils at this site with that combination of treatments you see right here that are just as productive within 2 years in corn as any topsoil return at the same site. Now, there are some other properties we want to deal with briefly, and then I'll sort of harp on later on. We've talked a little bit so far about the toxic metals, the pH issues. In certain parts of the world and in certain sites in any parts of the world, we're going to see other soil limitations due to salts and sodium. Figure 10.7, which is slide 34 here, shows sort of a classic shot of salinity in soils versus sodicity. Sodicity running along the bottom there is typically measured by the SAR, which is the sodium adsorption ratio. Anything above 10 to 15 is problematic. Salinity on the y-axis there is shown in decisiemens So per centimeter, that should actually be millimoles per centimeter. That's a typo I just saw there. Apologize for that. But normal soils are usually low salt, low sodium. You'll see the dotted line there. That's the outer dash line of a survivability of really halophytes. In general, I want to keep the EC less than 4 to 5. Now, on many mining sites, particularly tailing sites and sulfate sites, you can't do that. And in general, I also want to keep the sodium adsorption ratio less than 10 out of 15. The reason for that is when the sodium adsorption ratio gets above that, first of all, the pH has a bad habit of jacking up above 9, and that causes real problems. And secondly, it causes soil dispersion, which then drastically inhibits water penetration. In 35, though, I sum up some important things about salinity in these soils. Generally, in most sites in the east or the more humid regions, if I can take care of sulfates and eliminate pyrite oxidation, usually EC or saltiness is not a problem. Not always, but usually. The other thing we've got to be careful of is that in most mining sites and tailings, the salt load is due to sulfates. The standard way of measuring it actually uses a KCL standard, and I don't want to spend too much time on it here, but when you're in a sulfate system and say if you look at the EC value of it, if it says 4, I'll guarantee you there's a lot more sulfate salt in a sulfate system at 4 than in a chloride system at 4. So you've got to be careful about that. And I'll show you later examples of in certain waste systems, even in extremely humid environments, we can see some very high EC values, but usually they're due to sulfate weathering or acid sulfate process. And then here's one example of that. Then towards the end, we'll talk about the site that's in Poland. A lot of times you can have high EC, high pH show materials that particularly for zinc can simultaneously be very high soluble zinc, and they can be really difficult and problematic to be dealing with. On 37, then, we'll move and sum up, then, I think, what are three important approaches dealing with any material that you've got to keep straight to develop an effective reclamation, rehabilitation, restoration strategy, or whatever you choose to call it. And again, these are my personal opinion. One is, I think you need to have some concept of what the conditions were, either disturbance, before disturbance at that site, or what your target is. What are you trying to return the site to? And a lot of times to do that, you need to look for a local reference or a local comparative area. Secondly, you really need to do everything you can do to understand how the site development process, be it mining or waste filling or construction or whatever happened to it, impacted the soil and site conditions during the disturbance process and after. Be it compaction, be it mixed thing, filling, just you really need to spend time to try and sort out what the heck these folks did to make this site look like it did. And finally, which is the real art and science of it, on 3 here, you need to be able to predict how the soil site and vegetation conditions are going to change with time. Because these are often essentially primary successional systems to the extreme. And you're going in there to a site with almost nothing on it, very low biotic activity, if any. You're doing the remedial treatments to it, and it is going to change dramatically over time. And how that changes and how that changes relative to your target is a very important thing to at least try to predict and have concept of, because you need to have some reference point to say whether or not you've been successful or not. So in summary to this introductory material, we have found that with few exceptions, and I'll show you a few later on, that almost any mine waste or overburden can be reclaimed once you do the proper suite of analyses on it that I'll talk about. But first and foremost, if it's sulfitic and it doesn't take a lot of sulfides, just a couple tenths of a percent of pyritic sulfur can cause you great problems. And if you've got to deal with it, it's going to take an awful lot of lime. Assuming you can get rid of the sulfitic materials, then compaction is the major thing you're dealing with, because that's going to limit rooting, water holding, and site hydrology. I'll talk a bit later on about the applications of some of these waste products. There's a lot of waste products, a lot of residuals available in very large amounts that can have great utility, but they all have some vagaries and they all may have some limitations in themselves that you've got to keep straight. Also, conventional amendments like compost and lime, if you can afford them and get them to a site in combination, can have tremendous effects. So part two here, before the first Q&A period, I'm going to try and take you through a sequence of two examples, both in mining sites, where we've looked at what are the sets of properties you need to evaluate on a site, and then how do you put together a soil reconstruction protocol. First of all and foremost, you need to understand what's going on with upon oxidation. I've got a couple of sample reports and presentations posted to the website. You can get lost in pyrite oxidation. This is a greatly simplified version of it. A couple things I want to point out. If we start up at the upper left-hand corner here, that's FeS2, iron pyrite. It gets brought to the surface in some way, reacts with water and oxygen, oxidizes to sulfuric acid. Reaction 2 there is the direct oxidation of iron 2 via oxygen, and that would also be as pyrite. Important point here is pyrite doesn't oxidize very quickly just by oxygen hitting it, all right? It does oxidize, but it's a slow process. Reaction 3 there, though, is the iron 3 that gets generated from the pyrite oxidation itself. It's going to hydrolyze, and it's going to generate more acidity. So I not only get acidity coming from the first sulfate oxidation step, the iron hydrolysis generates it. The fourth reaction is perhaps the most important. What reaction 4 shows is iron 3 itself in solution with water directly attacks pyrite. This is an extremely fast reaction, and what happens is when the pH drops under 4.5, there's a nasty little suite of bacteria down there, Thiobacillus being one of them, that suck up the iron 2 from solution, oxidize it to iron 3, and then this goes into a catalysis step. And depending on who you want to listen to, when the pH drops under 4.5 in these systems, and the bacteria mediated the catalysis kicks in, the rate of this reaction increases anywhere from 1,000 to 10,000 times. So what we routinely see is with sulfitic materials, the pH slowly dropping with time to the mid-4s, and all of a sudden it gets in the low-4s, and it's like someone threw a darn light switch, and you've got pH 2 tomorrow. 43 then talks about how we commonly estimate this, and again, we could spend hours and hours and hours just talking about this topic. We basically use something called acid-base accounting, which basically tries to balance out what is the acid-forming material or potential, and that's called potential acidity, and that's coming from sulfur against what is the native liming content. And this concept is called acid-base accounting and was essentially invented by Richard Smith and his students working on coal mining sites in the 1970s in West Virginia. 44 shows a scanning electron micrograph of the kind of pyrite that really causes problems. The pyrite you can see, the massive crystalline pyrite you can see in coal or fool's gold, is so large and so highly crystalline and has such low reactive surface area that it's typically not the bad actor. Framboidal pyrite is what is shown here. It is submicron to several microns in size, very porous, very high surface area. This is the material. We've had sites in Virginia that were dominated by framboids that when originally exposed in a road cut were pH 8 and literally within a month were pH 2.5. That's how reactive this stuff is. So to neutralize it, then you've got to add lime to it. And the classic approach is via calcium carbonate. The balanced reaction is shown here. What's not shown here is some of the atomic weight ratios. But at the bottom is a very important fact. If I've got 1% pyritic sulfur in a waste or a material, and I've got 1,000 tons of it. Now, we use the 1,000 tons number because that's what 1 acre of sediment or tailing 6 inches deep weighs. That's going to take 31 tons of lime to neutralize. So, again, if we look at 46, it is summarized again. So anything that tests out that has a net lime demand, expresses calcium carbonate, that it is going to need more than 5 tons of net lime per 1,000 tons in surface mining law and general mining lingo worldwide is regarded as so potentially toxic. That convention we use there, again, the parts per 1,000 unit, again, we use that because if I take 1 acre of soil or sediment on the average day in the average county, 6 inches deep, it's going to weigh about 1,000 tons. So again, the other rule of thumb that's back on 45 is for every 1% pyritic sulfur, I'm going to need 32 tons of lime per acre, 6 inches deep. And we routinely deal with materials out there that are 1, 2, and 3% sulfur that therefore need 30, 60 to 100 tons of lime, 6 inches deep, and twice that much per acre foot. Now, there are some important things about acid-base accounting and how it works. And again, we've got a lot more detail on this on the website. It assumes complete reaction of the acid-forming components with the neutralizers. The problem with that is in highly sulfitic materials, the pyrite can oxidize much quicker than carbonate can dissolve. On 47, we talk about a couple other problems. One is carbonates can very readily get coated up with coatings that then keeps them from being soluble further on. Depending on what kind of carbonate or lime you're using, they have widely varying reaction rates. On 48 here, in a macro scale, I'm going to show an example of this iron armoring effect. Those are limestone boulders there in that little creek, and the iron oxide is forming on them. The same thing actually happens and has been shown conclusively in happening even on very fine silt-sized particles of lime, that in a highly reactive sulfitic system, the iron oxide will coat them up, rendering them ineffective with time. So there are some vagaries and some things to deal with in this acid-base accounting approach. For that reason, worldwide, when people deal with highly reactive sulfitic tailings, like are shown here up at this beautiful site in central Montana, there's been a bias towards doing acid-base accounting, figuring out what is the total lime need of this material, and then doubling it. And that's sort of like an extra, the conservative dose of lime, I would think. On 50, I just want to point out that there's other ways of estimating the potential acidity. The one at the top here, the oxidation with H2O2 is the technique we typically use here, but there are other ones listed there. 51 shows a figure from a dissertation, which is actually posted to our website by Zena Orndorff. Spent a lot of time. The point of this is what you see across the bottom there is the percent sulfitic sulfur in samples, and then running up the y-axis there is the predicted lime need based on the hydrogen peroxide technique. Basically what the technique does is I take a sample, I bathe it in H2O2 peroxide. That makes all the sulfur in it oxidized to sulfuric acid. It then presumably reacts with any of the free lime around it, and the net acid generating ability of the sample is revealed. What we were impressed with this chart she's shown here is that there is a really tight relationship there then of the total percent sulfide and the total predicted liming need there shown by this technique. The reason I point this out is this particular technique is relatively inexpensive and cheap. We can run this for, say, $10 or $15. The full bore acid base accounting can cost as much as several hundred dollars, depending on which contract lab you're dealing with. So, in summary of all of that material, again, pyrite oxidation is a major thing we need to deal with and overcome. It's the dominant problem on many of these sites. Accurate prediction of the rate of pyrite oxidation and the net water quality effects has all these complications in it. We could spend a couple days just talking about how to deal with these. The point is there are a couple techniques, and acid-base accounting and other variants are fairly widely accepted. They're not perfect, but they will generate reasonable lime requirement estimates. Now, in the last few slides here, before we go to a Q&A, I'll just show you, again, a couple of fast examples of some of the soil reconstruction of procedures we've used. And, again, there's much more detail on the website. This is a mining site on slide 54 here, a typical coal mining site in the east. The oxidized material you see there, high brown and oxidizes, is about OPH5. The lower material, though, is a much better, and it's got a higher pH and a couple percent of carbonates in it. when we look at a site like this, this is the laundry list and sequence of things we analyze for and the ranking list. So first we look for the potential acidity. Then we look for the rock type and the kind of texture. Then we look for the nutrients in it. But we know that both nutrients and pH are things that our soil tests really don't test for that well. So we usually don't worry a lot about that as long as we have the potential acidity estimated. We then look at the soluble salts, like I talked about. We avoid salty materials. We then look at how weathered the stuff is. The more weathered material generates a finer textured spoil. And then we think about the thickness and the location. Can I get the strata out of where it's being mined and back on the surface where I want? And so these are the analyses we typically do and cascade down through. When I can get the right stuff up there, then I then place it at the final surface, and then I do the minimal grading to it possible to minimize compaction. And that's what's shown in slide 56 here. In 57, then, I'll take you to a completely different location. This is a mineral sands mine in eastern Virginia. We now have several thousand acres in eastern Virginia through the Carolinas. It's greatly enriched with titanium and zirconium. The complicating factor here is it's prime farmland, but it's got significant heavy minerals to a depth of 15 meters, and this stuff is worth about 10 times as much as coal, and is much more concentrated here. Slide 58 shows the typical pre-mining soil. This is prime farmland. This is some of the best corn and peanut land in Virginia. But the challenges are then how do you look at a soil profile like this and how do you come up with a soil reconstruction protocol to get you back to hopefully something that in a post-mining landscape would actually support a similar agricultural system. 59 shows after the heavy mineral has been separated out of it, the tailings and what they call the slimes are pumped back in these ponds. For a number of reasons, they get right back on them as soon as possible and just grade the you-know-what out of them. So we end up, again, having compaction issues. Slide 60 shows the resultant mine soil. Now, they, at this point in time, were following all the procedures that we and others had mandated. They were returning topsoil. Not only doing that, if you look, there's two bands there, one at 40 and one at 60, where they're actually burying topsoil, which is not a good thing. But look how compact that soil looks. The whole process here of getting these materials out on any mining site and any reconstruction site I've ever dealt with using dozers and pans just compacts these things intensely. So the answer to that, at least the compaction side of it, is shown in 61. And that is to get on a site like this and deep rip it. And here it's been deep ripped before the topsoil is on it, and then the topsoil would be laid over this ripped area and then loosened again with a chisel plow. And again, we have found that when we do this appropriately, we see a tremendous effect of deep ripping on these soils and really obvious effects, like when it rains on this. In fact, it had rained an inch the day before I took this picture, and every bit of that rainfall had infiltrated on this site. So the point is we need to come up with combinations of getting the right material out there, figuring out what are the mixes of amendments for it, and dealing with the physical properties over time. Finally, in 62 here, we show this is the ripper, and it was really interesting. The mining industry uses these all the time, usually for ripping up materials and ripping up roads. They usually don't use them for actually loosening soils. All that it took me at this mining site was to walk in the office one day, tap on the shoulder of this guy here. His name is Clint. Say, Clint, I want you to come out here and look at these soil pits with me. I showed him the soil pits. I just showed you a couple of them slides back and said, we got to do something here. He goes, Lee, it's no problem. I'll just buy a ripper. So he bought a couple of these rippers. At scale, they tell me they can rip these lands for less than $200 per acre, and that's a very reasonable cost. And so the point of this is there's sometimes some simple fixes that can be done on these sites that we just need to work with the engineers and work with the people who work with these pieces of equipment and specify them. So that's the first 45 minutes or so. I know I've blown through a lot of material awfully quickly here, but Gene, if there's any questions at this point.
Yeah, we have that. Thanks, Lee. I'm going to start with the questions that have been submitted online, and then we'll move over to taking those from the phone lines. I'm just going to run down. We've got about five of them that came in online. The first one is coming from William, who's calling or typing in from Fox Ridge Marketing. He asked, I was wondering what is the success rate for phytoremediation for site restoration?
phytoremediation. I'm not going to go there. I have not personally worked in phytoremediation. I work quite a bit with Rufus Cheney and others who have, but I don't really feel qualified to talk. I can tell you that there's a huge range of estimates on the efficacy of phytoremediation. What I can say is, from my perspective, I have not seen many materials anywhere that I could not revegetate, that I could not stabilize that soil surface with a living plant cover. But phytoremediation obviously has a lot of other meanings to it, and I'm frankly not expert in that area.
Thanks. And William, this is Jean from the Technology Innovation Program. We have a lot of resources on cluein.org, so I would suggest that you take a moment after the seminar and just search for phytoremediation and site restoration, and I'm sure there are a number of resources that might be able to help you with any other questions you have. Moving on to the next question, this is coming in from the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. They ask, what is the physical chemical mechanism that makes compaction form a more toxic soil or rock? Is it airflow?
Compaction has a number of effects. One is it's just direct mechanical impedance of rooting. There's critical bulk densities that once you get above them, and in general for a finer textured soil it's about 1.45, and for a sand it's about 1.75 and 1.8. And it varies by texture, but when the soil gets packed above that point, roots cannot effectively penetrate it. So that's the first effect, is you just can't root through it, and then that limits root penetration, water holding, and all those things. Also, then limits the activity of organisms, earthworms. The only direct toxicity would be redox-related, and that's going to vary widely. But when you get a compacted zone, it will perch water and saturate the shallow soil. It'll go anaerobic, and then you can have lots of redox-related secondary products that can be phytotoxic in certain instances. But compaction per se isn't phytotoxic, but it's definitely root limiting.
Okay. The next question is coming again from Fox Ridge Marketing. This is Jean's question. And she asks, it appears that the restoration approaches mentioned in the presentation will help with carbon sequestration. Is this something that should be considered?
Yes. In fact, a lot of agencies are looking very hard at can you take these broad extents. For example, we have hundreds of thousands of acres of coal mine lands in the central Appalachians that are fairly low soil quality, and I'm involved in a number of projects here at Virginia Tech regionally looking at how do we apply some minimal treatments, tillage and other things, to these mine lands to increase carbon sequestration potential. That's a very viable area. Yes.
The next question comes from Gary from Argonne National Lab, and he just wants clarification. He says that the units shown on these slides, MG/HA, HA is referring to a hectare, and MG is?
I apologize for that, and I should have cleaned that up. That's metric tons per hectare, so that would be long tons. A megagram is 1,000 kilos. That's a metric ton, and a hectare is a hectare. If you divide those numbers by 2, you're pretty close to tons per acre. All right, so in one example slide where it says 140 megagrams per hectare, that would be a little less than 70 tons per acre.
Okay, and the final question that came in online comes from a consultant in Wilmington, Delaware, and he asks, what is the best form of lime to use? What are some typical liming rates for the reclaimed sites mentioned? And then we've got one more part. What are some measures to reduce soil compaction on the restored sites?
Okay. Liming comes with a lot of caveats. The most common form of lime is obviously calcium carbonate, either as calcitic lime or as dolomitic lime, which has the magnesium in it. If you're not in an extremely acid-forming system where the coating problems I talked about are issues, then usually that's the best form of lime to be using. If you are in an extremely reactive sulfitic system, we often use calcium oxide or calcium hydroxide. It's much more expensive, but it is much more reactive and usually isn't hit with the same problems of coating. But in general, calcium carbonate is the best source. We also use other products I'll be talking about later, like alkaline fly ash can also be a liming product. The liming rate will vary widely. It just needs to be properly spec'd based on an appropriate soil test or a test of potential acidity. Compaction, particularly if you're south of the polar regions, the only way to get rid of it is physical deep ripping. There is some evidence that things like alfalfa over decades may loosen it a little bit, but on a practical basis, subsoil compaction, anything deeper than a foot or so, and that's typically a problem, needs to be mechanically loosened. You need to pull a ripper through it. There's lots of folks out there who think that by simply adding gypsum to the surface and some other surface treatments, it'll loosen subsoil compaction. Gypsum and surface treatments will do a fine job up in the surface, but when you get down under a foot or so and you've got these subsoil pans, the only way I know and the only practical way we've seen of actually loosening them is to pull some kind of a ripper through them.
Okay, thanks, Lee. Let's move on to those individuals who are participating by phone. If you have a question for Lee, you can unmute your phone by pressing #6 or depressing your own mute button. And I'll just open up the phone lines to anyone who has a question now. Again, press #6 to unmute your phone line. Okay, I guess there's no questions coming in from those on the phone, so we can move on to the next part. Again, I would remind everyone, if you haven't done so already, keep your phones on mute by pressing *6. And if you have questions or have technical difficulties, be sure to use that question mark button to submit them, and we'll get to them at the next Q&A break. Thanks, Lee. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you, Jean. My plan here now is to go through to the end of the presentation. When I go through the case studies, I'll go through some things fairly quickly, and then leave about 15 or so minutes towards the end of the talk to handle questions again. This next section then is part of the overall soil reconstruction amendment portion. And here I'll talk particularly about the use of organics. Now, I want to say right now that you'll see a number of examples here utilizing biosolids, and I have done a lot of work with biosolids over time. I want to make it clear to everyone that the major reason I've used biosolids is they tend to be readily available. There are lots of organics out there that are very effective, particularly a wide range of composted products that are just as effective on many, many sites as are the biosolids. But in general, when we can combine an organic amendment with an appropriate lime and fertilizer amendment, we usually see the best response in terms of soil reconstruction. On 64, then I'll talk about some of the background of work we've done. I've been working on biosolids extensively since about 1980. They've been used at what's called a higher than agronomic rate. Now, an agronomic rate would be the rate of biosolid you would put, for example, on a corn crop this year to only supply the nitrogen that corn crop needs or that pasture. They're typically put on higher rates on mining sites for a number of reasons I'll talk about later on as a soil building amendment with the understanding that I'm necessarily loading on a lot more nutrients than would be used in the first year. Both work done by Bill Sopper and colleagues at Penn State in the 70s and then by folks working with me since have shown that in general this is a very beneficial practice, and in general we have not seen significant ground and surface water impacts, and that's what I'll be talking about. It's an example of one of the earlier sites we looked on, and here's that unit again, that's megagrams per hectare. So now that would be about 65 tons per acre of a mixture of biosolids plus wood chips being land applied there. Now, and again, the intention there is that on 66 here we can see is you can rebuild the topsoil, you can put in 5 or 6% organic matter at one shot, and on slide 67 though we see all the other stuff you're adding. And a lot of times it's all the other stuff you're adding with any other waste product that is of the concern. At the top of the table there, we see carbon. Now, obviously, I'm adding an awful lot of carbon. I'm adding 121 So tons per hectare here of carbon, which would be, you know, about 50, 60 tons per hectare. That's 5 or 6% organic matter added right back in. I'm adding thousands of kilos per hectare. Now, a kilo per hectare is almost exactly a pound per acre, so that's almost the same unit. So I'm adding thousands of pounds per acre of nitrogen and phosphorus, calcium, and magnesium, but I'm also adding some of these other materials, some zinc and copper. Now, that's good and bad. Zinc and copper are essential plant micronutrients, but if plant available or bioavailable at larger concentrations, they can be a problem. And then almost any waste product I put out there will also have some other material in it. And here, showing a little bit of lead, nickel and cadmium. But all this was well under applicable EPA 503 standards at the time. Now, let me back up. Still at 67. Very important point here is the carbon to nitrogen ratio. Now, at this particular site, we put down not just biosolids, which is of course, processed sub-sewage sludge materials. We also put wood chips with it. The intention of that was to get something called the carbon-to-nitrogen ratio up above 25-1. And in fact, at this site, it was almost 30-1. The reason for that is when I can get the CN ratio of a product like this in the range of 25-1, or say 40-1, that essentially stabilizes much of the nitrogen in the product. It's going to end up turning into organic matter or being tied up in the active microbial biomass, and it's not going to leach. If I put down this much of any organic with a lower CN ratio, particularly lower than 20-1, I'm going to expect much more nitrate being flushed to the system than is needed for plant uptake, and I would expect leaching problems. So at this particular site I just showed you, if we change forward to slide 68, we actually treated 150 hectares, and so that would be over 300 acres with this mixture. This is a picture taken about 6 months after it was treated. It had a CN ratio of about 30, and that was by design at this site. And there were, our concern here about monitoring was whether or not we would have nitrate leaching. Well, we monitored the site for 9 months before application and 5 years after application and found that, in fact, the nitrate N levels in groundwater dropped precipitously after we treated the site. And the reason for that is the common use of ammonium nitrate in explosives. So another sort of semi-amusing aspect of doing some of this work is you look for certain things and often find outcomes you weren't looking for. So based on that work, the state of Virginia then adopted what I'll call a standard that on coal mining sites that the standard loading rate as a biosolid would be 35 dry tons per acre or 50 dry tons per acre if some other carbonaceous material like sawdust or wood chips was added with it. However, then we were immediately asked to apply the similar technology to sand and gravel mines in the east. This was, by the time we got to this, was the mid-1990s. The Chesapeake Bay concerns had reared their ugly little heads, and there was even more concern about nitrate leaching. So then we went into another follow-up experiment, and there's great detail on all these experiments, and all these papers are posted to the website. At Shirley Plantation, then, which is on the James River, we put a loading rate experiment out where we varied the loading rate to some fairly high rates and with and without adding carbon with it. We did it at large scale. Each of these plots was about a third of an acre in size. In the foreground here, you can see one of the loading rate plots going down just as biosolid, so that didn't have any sawdust added with it. Now, that going down has a CN ratio of 8. Any organic material with a CN ratio less than 15-1 or 20-1, particularly if I put it on just a little bit too heavy, will definitely be a nitrate leaching risk, which is what we're dealing with here. That loading rate there, 42 tons per hectare, would be about 18 tons per acre, and that would have been about three times the agronomic rate for corn at this particular site. This is a picture of some adjacent plots on unmined land adjacent to it. This is taken over 1 year after application. You can very clearly see the carryover effect of the organic matter addition in the vegetation there versus the area in the lighter green is what we call the research alleyways. And this is slide 71 I'm looking at now. What we did, though, and this is on slide 72 at this site, this is the research loading rate plots on the sand and gravel mine land. In the background, you can see a pond. That pond is essentially equal in elevation to the water table at this site. The water table extended under the research site where Ronnie is standing right here. We had zero tension lysimeters buried at about a meter or about 40 inches down. The water table at this location was about 5 feet down. Now, a zero tension lysimeter, what it does is it basically collects that water that is free flowing and leaching downward through soils that would leach naturally to recharge groundwater. And if we look at 73, we can see some of the nitrate leaching data from that site. On the left hand side is the first sampling date where we saw leachates. Now, the biosolids were applied in April of 1996. They were put into corn for the entire growing season during the summer of 96. There were no leachates because of the water budgets. The corn was sucking all the water out. The corn was chopped and harvested in early September, and by late September we saw leachates. The red line is seven times the agronomic rate for corn of the biosolids. The blue line is one, and then there's a zero fertilizer and fertilizer lines. What you see here then is that first winter after biosolids application as biosolids, a dramatic effect of biosolids loading rate on nitrate in the lysimeter leachates. You then chain forward through the spring of 97, they are dropping off. Over the entire following cropping season of 97 and of 98, which is sort of magically missing from this figure here, we saw absolutely no leaching, and even the following winter there, you see that one date of January 14, 98, and the following spring of 98, we saw no carryover effect the second year. Where in the summer of 98, you do see all those lines jacking up a little bit there. That's where the farmer, without listening to us, ran over the research plots and surface applied in fertilizer, and that just told us that our lysimeters were actually functioning. So the take-home message here is nitrate leaching, at least from the rooting zone, is going to be a direct function of loading rate of the biosolids. On slide 74, then, we see what happened to the same system when we added sawdust. Now, we added enough sawdust to get the CN ratio to about 23 to 1. We had wanted it to be higher than that. We had wanted 30 to 1. However, the biosolids that came into us that week were significantly higher in nitrogen than we expected, and so the CN ratio was lower than we wanted. Regardless, you can see that across all treatments, with the exception of that 5X biosolids treatment, that by adding sawdust to the blend, we significantly reduced nitrate leaching. We still saw it occurring at the 5X rate and the 7X rate. The reason for the rate inversion there, again, you would think that you'd see more nitrate leaching at the 7X rate, and that's about 50 dry tons per acre than the 5X rate. We think what happened there is that was so much carbon and so much organic matter added to that system with the sawdust added, it got very wet and soupy. We actually think we had denitrification occurring and a gaseous loss of that in. It looked like the 5X rate was just the ideal optimal for generating leachate in. Now, on slide 75, though, I sum up some data that you can find in the posted papers. The interesting thing is while we did see this root zone leachate effect, particularly in the biosolids without the carbon added to them, we did see the direct effect of the CN ratio. We only saw the effects the first winter after application. The second and third winters, we saw no effects. So the nitrate leaching effect seems to be a first winter effect. We did have four groundwater wells around the entire experiment that showed no effects. So while we were leaching nitrates, when you do a mass calculation on it, it was typically less than 10 kilos per hectare, even though the concentrations in those root zone leachates were fairly high. So on 76, then, I'll sort of change gears and talk about some other types of organic amendments we've used. There's, in addition to biosolids, there's also a lot of paper mill sludges out there. Now, they tend to be highly variable. This is one example of a really wonderful product generated by Mead Paper out of Kingsport, Tennessee, where they actually mix a little bit of waste clay, a little bit of lime, a little bit of fly ash with their paper mill of sludge and put it down as a mixed product to us. This is on coal waste, on acid forming coal waste. The net lime demand of this coal waste is about 10 tons of lime per acre, 6 inches deep, or 10 tons per 1,000 tons. The plots you see there with the bright green verdant color, those are the ones that got the 50 tons per hectare of the mill sludge and the lime added with it. The plots that are bare or have limited vegetation got lime and fertilizer but didn't have the paper mill sludge with them. So again, when I combine lime and organic amendments, I usually see this. I don't want to misuse the term, but this almost synergistic effect of these combined amendments in terms of revegetation effects. So again, this mixed product, which is just outstanding, if we then chain forward to slide 77, it had net positive effects on pH, water holding capacity, and fertility. What we found interesting here is even though this product had a high CN ratio, anytime the CN ratio gets above 40:1 to 50:1, we often say, oh, I better add some extra N fertilizer to the system because it's going to need it. What we found is even though the CN ratio of this product was about 150:1, it didn't need any N fertilizer. In fact, we saw no N fertilizer response. So again, there, it looked like the CN ratio either wasn't accurate, but we also had carbonates in that system, and that was part of that issue. On 78, I summarize up some other issues. We've looked at, about a dozen or so different paper mill sludges. About five or six of those, I say, are paper studies where we've just focused on the lab properties of the materials. We've actually done replicated field work, though, with five or six materials. Biosolids tend to be relatively uniform once you figure them out, I'll put it that way. Mill sludges tend to be highly plant-specific. So if you're going to use a paper mill sludge in a reclamation or a revegetation project, you really need to look at it carefully. Many of them have sodium in them. Many of them are salty. Many of them have stability issues, and what I mean by that is they may need composting. We've seen some of them that had been partially composted and not composted enough and were actually phytotoxic. That being said, paper mill sludges do offer at many locations a very viable source of organic amendment for these kinds of sites. Slide 79 then continues on this vein. The basic relationships, the basic soil science of CN ratio and how much infertility we need just falls apart with these mill sludges. Everyone we've tested is different. Part of it is that a lot of the carbon that's in a mill sludge is fairly recalcitrant to the bacteria, so they don't want to chew on it, so they don't need nitrogen. Now, that being said, it still does a fine job of adding organic matter to the soils. And again, anytime you're using a mill sludge, there are particularly public issues with the possibility of the dioxins content, so 2,3,7,8, so TCDD, and its isomers. And but with bleaching changing with time, those levels for most materials have been dropping over time. Slide 80 shows the effects of another common material we've done a lot of work with, and that's coal fly ash, particularly alkaline fly ash. This is on a coal waste pile. Again, this coal waste pile is actually the same one I showed in the picture about five back. It has a net liming need of about 10 tons of calcium carbonate lime per acre 6 inches deep, or 10 parts per thousand. The check plot on the left where we did nothing except add the seed and mulch, you can see what happened there. The check plot on the right got lime, NPK, and fiber mulch, and it got partially vegetated. The plot in the middle got 33% alkaline fly ash by volume mixed in with it, and this picture is taken after 2 years. The kicker here is, though, that for the first 6 months, this plot wouldn't grow anything because the salts were so high. So, again, anytime you're using a coal combustion product, you need to watch out for salts. and that leads us to picture 81. This is showing the soluble salt and boron effect. Most fly ash materials and many of the FGD materials, which is the scrubber sludges, and again, we have quite a bit of detail on this topic posted to the website. If you're using them at rates that are high enough to actually affect texture and actually get enough lime in a bulk basis into soils, you're often adding enough salt and boron content with them initially that it's going to suppress plant growth, particularly legumes like this soybean plant, which are particularly sensitive. This picture just shows classic soluble salt damage to the soybean plant. However, once those salts leach, and again, the bulk salt is sulfate, and then nested within it is borate. Once the bulk salts leach, which usually happens the first winter, this ends up being a very good soil amendment in most instances. The other thing I'll talk briefly about fly ash and what you need to be careful about is the presumption of fly ash is often that it's all alkaline and has lots of lime in it. That's not true. Most fly ash is alkaline, but some is actually acidic. Most fly ash has a total lime content on a calcium carbonate basis of less than 10%. So if you're using fly ash as a liming agent per se, you're going to have to put an awful lot of fly ash down, and then when you do that, again, you're engendering all these salt effects I just talked about. That being said, I am an advocate of using fly ash and other coal combustion products at appropriate rates in mining environments. Now, in figure 82, I show the effects of acid coal waste leaching in untreated columns in another experiment we did looking at fly ash. So again, a lot of coal fly ash and other alkaline coal combustion products are commonly being backhauled now, particularly in the eastern coal fields, for their liming ability to be mixed with acid-forming materials like this. And again, we have some very, very hot, very reactive sulfated coal waste materials that in a matter of weeks are capable of generating leachates like this at pH 2.3, and that's 10,000 ppm iron. That's 1% iron. Very nasty stuff. So there have been a lot of permits issued and a lot of interest in taking large volumes of alkaline fly ash and bulk blending it with this acid-forming material. Slide 83 shows the net long-term leaching effects of adding various rates of two different fly ashes with the same coal waste I just showed you in those leaching columns, so very acid-forming waste. And yes, that's weeks. This was Barry Stewart's work. Barry was a pretty unique PhD student in that it took him almost 4 years to finish, and he actually monitored these columns, these leaching columns, for over 3 years. The light blue lines you see there, that's the bulk refuse. And it starts up at pH 5, and then it within weeks drops to pH 1.8 and stays that way for 3 years. So that's what we're sort of comparing things to. The red and the black symbols of the top lines up there at pH 8, those are the columns that got high loading rates of the alkaline fly ash, and they were able to maintain a high pH condition over the complete time of that study. So that's where the system worked. Now look though at the purple symbol, the 5% line, and then the 10% symbol coming in at week 40 dropping down, and the 20% symbol coming in at week 100. Those are the lower rates of a fly ash that was only moderately alkaline. And what's happening there is those columns then are acidifying sequentially with time as the alkaline loading is overcome. And the problem with that is that if you look at the Stewart et al. Article or the other things posted to our website, is as those columns acidify, there is tremendous co-release of zinc, manganese, and other metals that's actually in the fly ash. So the point of all this is that when we're going to work with strongly acid-forming materials, and when I'm bringing in alternative liming agents to deal with them, I really need to make darn sure that in the long run, I've got the acid-base balances right, because if I don't do it right, the net water quality effect could be much worse than not doing anything. I also want to point out, at this point in time, I've been working with Ellen Rubin within US EPA and a lot of other folks to develop and publish a white paper on the use and application of various residuals at the Superfund type sites, brownfield sites. That white paper includes really detailed tables with lots of references that a lot of us have worked on. It has a very large matrix that basically crosses over all the properties I've been talking about here with site properties and residual properties and tells you what you look for and the, say, the relative viability of using one approach versus another one, and it has full information on coal mining sites, metal mining sites, and a number of other types of waste. Moving on to 85, we'll talk fairly quickly about using lime. That actually came up as an early question. Anytime you put lime on any site, any soil, needs to be done on a CCE or calcium carbonate basis. But it can be added in as many different forms, usually as calcium carbonate. Again, most conventional lime applications assume incorporation to 6 inches, the magical acre furrow slice or the 1,000 tons. Obviously, on a mining site or a waste site, a lot of times you simply can't get it mixed in. However, even if you put the lime at the surface, while you don't get the bulk depth liming effect, you will see some positive benefits from it. On 86, we talk about, at the top, really what you're trying to do. Liming and pH control in general are going to knock down aluminum, iron, lead, copper, cadmium, and nickel. The thing you got to watch out for, though, is arsenic, selenium, and moly, as arsenic, selenate, and molybdate may actually be increased in solubility if you raise the pH. So if these are issues at a given site, you have to be very careful about the pH targets you set because you actually may enhance the solubility of these oxyanions. Zinc, also particularly in a sulfate form, is a real monster to deal with. We've seen lots of sites that had high zinc in solution. We would lime them to pH 7.2 and they'd still kill plants. We had to actually make the soil calcareous and get up into 7.6, 7.8 range before we could re-vegetate them. The final point here is that regardless of what the system is, when the soil pH is low, regardless of what you do to all the other metals, you're still going to have aluminum and manganese in that system, and they will be phytotoxic, particularly under pH 5. Slide 87 talks a little bit about woody species. Important thing to point out is a lot of our natives, particularly the pines and oaks, do quite well in lower pH materials. So we have to be very careful about liming prescriptions if I'm going back to native woody species that the pH isn't too high. However, a lot of the species, hybrid poplars and some of the cove hardwoods, are fine at the higher pH values. Slide 88 then shows a typical approach we take using topsoil substitutes. And again, our presumption on any of these sites is that when I start here, I'm basically dealing with blasted rock, mineral material. I'm going to presume there's almost no organic matter and very low nitrogen, phosphorus in these spoils. Nitrogen, again, I'm on slide 89, is virtually all of these materials need in. We typically add it as fertilizer. We typically don't want to add more than 100 to 150 kilos per hectare or pounds per acre because when I put down more than that, I suppress legumes. Because what I really want to do is get legumes established into the system, like locust trees or clovers, so that their rhizobia can naturally fix nitrogen. And that's codependent on phosphorus levels. On slide 90, then, we look at a nice stand of co-established legumes and grasses. Our goal with herbaceous vegetation on sites like these is that I want to have at least 35% legume component in that stand initially for some reasons I'll talk about shortly. Now, phosphorus is also usually very, very low. Most mine soil forage plant systems respond dramatically to the P. However, woody species a lot of times kind of laugh at it. And the reason for that is woody species are often heavily mycorrhizal, and they can actually get phosphorus out of soils that a lot of times herbaceous species can't due to the enhanced effects of these fungal symbionts. Phosphorus is typically added anywhere from 150 to sometimes 300 kilos per hectare or pounds per acre to these seedings. On slide 92, then, another point about phosphorus is if I've got a lot of iron or calcium in the mine soil, a lot of the phosphorus I add is going to be fixed. On slide 93, I show a picture of some of this. This is goethite, which is iron oxy hydroxide. It'll act like a phosphorus sponge. So anytime I've got a high iron system, I've got to expect that I'll probably have some phosphorus limitations within that system. On slide 94, I talk about nitrogen and phosphorus codependency. The point of these is that nitrogen and phosphorus, for a lot of different reasons, are heavily interactive and heavily dependent on the mutual microbial biomass. And we have got to manage them and organic matter together for success. So there's lots of examples where phosphorus limits nitrogen and nitrogen limits phosphorus, and they're all together tied up with building and maintaining an active microbial biomass over time. On slide 95, then, we'll talk a little bit about the potassium. A potassium is the third fertilizer element that we commonly add and need. We're commonly putting it down at anywhere from 100 to occasionally 200 pounds per acre. Grasses and herbaceous materials particularly need fairly high K inputs, particularly if they're being mowed. Now, that being said, most mine spoils and rock spoils have so much potassium in it, we may not need to be fertilizing them at all, but acidic systems or highly weathered soils usually need a K added to them if they're the soil reconstruction medium. Slide 96 then speaks again to the importance of long-term mine soil management and the fact that when I can add an organic amendment at appropriate loading rates, and again, this loading rate concept is important, we need the loading rate. And I would suggest an appropriate loading rate is anywhere from 25 to maybe 50 to 60 tons per acre on a dry weight basis. That rebuilds the organic matter content, rebuilds the nitrogen phosphorus pools, enhances the overall microbial biomass, enhances water holding, but doesn't load so much available nitrate to the system that it poses a long-term risk. All right, from slide 97 on, I'll walk you through a couple of case studies that I hope will illustrate and amplify some of the things I've covered so far. The first one here is on slide 98. This is some work I did joint with EPA and USDA in 1994 through 2004 in Katowice, Poland. The Upper Silesia region of Poland was, frankly, an environmental sacrifice zone from the 60s through the 80s. There's thousands and thousands of acres of this smelter slag. This is the stuff that actually comes out of heavy metal smelters. The material in the background had been sitting there for 50, 60 years. The material in the foreground, we're told, had been sitting there for about the same period of time. This is clearly tremendously toxic material. High water-soluble zinc, high soluble cadmium, high salts. Slide 99 shows the tailings that were adjacent to the site. Now, this material was salty, but was not quite as high in cadmium and was actually higher pH. But these were the two materials that we were tasked with revegetating. Now, the intention of this revegetation was not to phytoremediate these sites. The intention of this is, while you can't see it here, there were people living within 100 yards of these sites, and we routinely had to shoo the kids and their bicycles off these sites. So the intention of this project was to come up with a vegetative barrier that would keep these materials in situ, keep them from blowing around, and if kids randomly went out there and fell on these sites, they wouldn't eat all the dust. So what we did is we worked this with Rufus Cheney at USDA and Tom Stuszynski of the Polish Institute of Plant Cultivation and a character named Ken Pantuck out of US EPA Region 3 Philadelphia, using local waste residual materials here, biosolids and water treatment lime. And then here's another one of these loading rate experiments being laid out on top of this waste. When we cleared this site, there was less than 1% living vegetation on these areas. The areas to the right is a more suitable type of a material called welts waste. This is in slide 101, a picture taken 2 years later looking back in the reverse way of that site. Now, the area that I'm immediately standing on when I took this picture was so salty. This This was a different type of a waste called dorsal waste that had so much salt in it that despite all the lime and all the biosolids we put on it, we couldn't revegetate it by putting that stuff in situ into it, so we ended up capping it again. And then it was seeded in 95. There in the background where the people are standing is the area I showed the picture of earlier. That was bare, and that is the two-year effect of the waistline and the biosolids, and very importantly, working with Tom Stuschinski, the local Polish scientist, he had connections to plant breeders, and that's mainly hard fescue out there that is salt tolerant and metal tolerant. And this is a picture taken just 2 years ago, looking down back the other way. You can very clearly see here essentially the line in the sand where the treatments were applied. Those trees you see there are invading on these plots with time. Now, a couple of them were planted, but that white birch was not. That white birch actually invaded in after the site was treated. Here's a picture of my colleague Tom. This is the area of the dorsal waste I was talking about. Now, this is an example of a waste product that I don't think we have any way of actually dealing with. This stuff is so salty, shoots an EC by saturated paste of 16 to 20. This is the kind of material that, unfortunately, a lot of the things I'm talking about here just don't work. This is the kind of material that probably needs some sort of a cap on it. On the other hand, if we look at slide 104, this is the tailings pile I showed you the shot of earlier. And very clearly here, again, it's like a line in the sand. To the right-hand side is the area we treated with a similar rate of biosolids. That got about 100 dry tons per acre of biosolids. It got about 10 tons per acre of waistline and seed right on top of it. The area to the left got lime and fertilizer and mulch, but did not get the biosolids. So again, there is what is a very interesting interaction between adding an organic amendment, particularly biosolids, and lime together that leads to these effects we've seen. And I won't talk about it here, but there's all kinds of evidence that we actually see suppression of metal toxicity, increasing metal sorption, decreasing bioavailability coupled with these combined treatments where they're put down and incorporated. And again, all those woody species you see there are invading on these plots. They weren't planted out there. On slide 105 then, we'll move to our next case study. Those of you in Washington, D.C., you're not far from this one. You ought to go down and see it. This is the Stafford Airport site. In the lower right-hand corner, there's Interstate 95. This is about a 400-acre site that was originally built in 1998 through 2000, hit sulfidic sediments at depth. They spoiled them up on the surface. The only areas where they brought the topsoil back in are the areas in this picture, 105, where you see anything green out there. The interesting thing at this particular site is sulfides in situ, if I've got a sulfidic sediment, and all this was a coastal plain sediment, sulfides in situ, if they get above 1% or 2%, they actually turn the soil color black, or the sediment color black. At this particular site, we have, I'd say, testimony from two of the local engineers that when they saw these black materials at depth, that they assumed that they were looking at organic-rich topsoiling material, so they intentionally spread them across the whole site. Slide 106 then shows a shot of a beaver pond complex. You can see the vegetation there. It was silt fenced off supposedly to protect the beavers. The areas to the north and south of the beaver ponds, there are two enormous above-grade fills that were loaded with these sulfidic materials, and that's the seepage you see in the ponds there. Note that the entire area there is bare. This area, when this picture was taken, had already been revegetated conventionally with 2 tons of lime per acre at a shot 3 separate times, and it kept failing. The reason for that, if we look at slide 107, was again, they had disturbed sulfidic sediments. And these sediments had an average of between 0.5% to 1% reactive sulfides. If we go on to slide 108, and this is what the site looked like. When we first hit the site in the fall of 2001, the average pH across the site was 3.6. There were pockets on this site of soil pH of 1.8, which is the lowest my laboratory has ever measured. My technician actually came down to me twice that day in November of 2001 and said, Lee, I got a pH down here I've never measured. I said, well, WT, recalibrate the pH meter and measure it again. It can't be. And he did it twice, and it was 1.8. So the entire site was extremely acidic. They cut as deep as 80 to 90 feet and then spoiled these sulfitic materials out. The average potential acidity across the whole site was about 15 tons per acre, 6 inches deep. Slide 109 shows erosion coming off of some of these fills, so we not only had the direct effects of the cut and fills, we had this acid sediment going everywhere and killing everything it hit. Slide 110 shows the off-site effects. The pH of the waters draining the site in the first order streams was in the low threes. In the second order receiving stream, the Potomac, the creek I'll show you shortly, was about 3.3. Now, this was just a 400-acre cell as part of a 2,000-acre watershed, but the 400-acre cell had taken the main stem of a second order stream and acidified it tremendously. Not only do we have issues with acidity, if you look at picture 111, acid sulfate materials, particularly the waters, eat galvanized metal and concrete alive. There's a large hole the size of a basketball here in this water control of structure, and so VDOT and others have similar materials issues in addition to water quality issues with these materials. 112 shows the condition of the pond on the Potomac Creek in the fall of 2001 had a pH of 3.3, and this was about a mile downstream. Slide 113 and summarizes basically what we did at the site. We again used lime-stabilized biosolids. Now, we did spec for them that the site could be completely reclaimed, revegetated with a combination of lime and yard waste compost. They did the cost estimate, though, and the cost of bringing the lime and the yard waste compost in and incorporated it was over $2 million for the site. So they were able to get biosolids from Blue Plains in D.C. and other locations for free. So for them, under a permit variance we got with the health department locally, we then actually calculated out what the loading rate was on 42 different cells and put the lime-stabilized biosolids down in the May of 2002. Slide 114 shows it being land-applied. We put it down on some pretty steep slopes. As long as you get back across it with a four-wheel drive tractor and incorporate it, it's okay. The house you see there shuttered up was not an issue. That was on an airport property. The house you see in the woods in the background was a house that for comfort was probably a little too close. We did have a number of odor complaints at this site. Slide 115 summarizes basically what we did, but again, the intention was to seed it completely by April of 2002. It was incorporated, was mulched, and was seeded to a mix of acid and salt tolerant grasses. Particularly hard fescue, Festuca ovina is really wonderful on sites like this. Slide 116 shows what the site looked like in the summer of 2002. Unfortunately, we had a record drought that summer. It sat out there bare. Slide 117, though, shows once it rained in the fall of 2003, was overseeded again. We have, and I've got similar pictures taken in 2006 and 7, we have maintained a complete vegetative stand on that site since the fall of 2002. Slide 118 summarizes some of the soil data. The surface soil pH is up in the 6s and 7s. The subsurface soil pH at a foot is still in the 2s, 3s, and 4s. So while we've got the surface soil stabilized, we still have some acid issues at depth. Slide 119 shows some water quality data. This is in the main stem of the creek at that pond. The dotted line there shows the pH. You'll see we started at 3.3, and over time it's now up about 6. What you will see is early on is at this particular site, under these conditions, we did have a nitrogen release issue. Now, this was all surface runoff. We first ran it off as ammonium under acid conditions, and once the pH raised, it came off as nitrate. This, again, was a first winter event, essentially, occurred initially after establishment, again, we had a bare site out there. If the site had been vegetated adequately, I think this probably would have been reduced, but I think we still would have seen losses at this site. So again, anytime you're dealing with a site, particularly using a nutrient-rich source like biosolids, we have to look at the fact that we've got nutrient mobility issues that have got to be dealt with. And that's what's covered on slide 120. 121, I'll switch gears on you again and talk about wetlands restoration, which will be our final topic here. I've done a lot of work with wetlands restoration and actually wetlands creation, which would be a better term here. These days, in Virginia anyway, sort of the state of the art is to go into a low flat landscape like this one. You can see the pre-existing soil surface to the left. Figure out where you think the water level is going to be. Cut it down. In this instance, they cut it down about 18 inches. Take the topsoil off and pile it off to the right-hand side there. And then leave it sitting in here flat as a pool table and think it's going to work. Now, obviously I'm being semi-cynical in that, but unfortunately a lot of sites, particularly those generated in the mid-1990s, were done like this with little attention paid to actually soil reconstruction. Slide 122 shows another site similar to that. This one is near BWI Airport up in Maryland. I've also worked at that one just off the Patuxent. Slide the 123 shows that same site a couple years later. The trees are still living and viable, but there was significant invasion of upland species, and I think that's largely because there was not any effort made to essentially recreate hydric soil conditions out there, and that's what I'll talk about here. And again, these are wetlands creation sites. This is not restoration. This is taking uplands that are previously upland sites and figuring out what you do to them to turn them into hopefully functioning wetlands. So again, we need to go back to some of the things I talked about earlier. We need to ask the question and look at slide 124 and think, what does a natural forested wetland soil look like? Well, it's going to have redox. It's going to have a lot of organic matter in it. It's going to show redox features. You see the dull gray colors in the iron banding here. It's going to have high organic matter content. It's going to be friable. And these sites, particularly in native forested wetlands, usually have remarkably low bulk density, usually less than 1:4 down through the soil, so they have deep rooting at least to the water table. Now, slide 125 shows a typical picture of the kinds of wetlands that through the 90s were being recreated, where I go into an upland site, I cut to the subsoil, and as part of that process, typically highly compacted, and then I bring an upland topsoil in and covered it. That's what's shown here in slide 125. Slide 126 then was taken 50 feet away from the previous picture. This is what the native wetland soil at that same site looks like. Again, very different, lots of organic matter, low bulk density. Now the only difference here is, I've got to admit, the one in the picture in 125 is taken on a very hot day in mid-July. The picture 126 was taken on a cooler, wetter day, the following fall, but you can still see the obvious differences in soil properties. Slide 127 shows some work Angie Cummings did working with us comparing mitigation site soil properties versus reference soil properties. It's very obvious. Anytime you do this comparison, and this work has been done by others in Pennsylvania and South Carolina and Delaware, mitigation site soils are almost always lower in carbon and nitrogen because they're lower in organic matter content. And particularly look at slide 128. The bulk densities are tremendously different. We usually see in these reference forested wetlands, particularly in the topsoil layer, we definitely see low bulk densities in the surface and moderate bulk densities in the subsurface. But mitigation sites almost always have high bulk densities both in the surface and the subsurface. So regardless of what else we do to them, regardless of how wet they are, they often are going to be root limited, particularly for the woody forested vegetation we're trying to reestablished back out there. So slide 129 is a map of a number of other study sites we've looked at in eastern Virginia. Slide 130 is a plan map of a typical site called Mattapani. The point I want to make there is, looked at about 60 to 70% of that site is designated to be forested wetlands. Now, forested wetlands are the most sensitive to restore in that they need what's called a hydroperiod or a wetness regime that dries down periodically during the summer, and they need a viable rooting depth. Slide 131 shows what that site looks like right after it was established. I do want to point out, you see that the material in the background there, that was the cut material pulled out of this wetland. It just so happened at this site they hit sulfitic materials. That's pH-3 material sitting over there. Slide 132 shows a table of data from those 10 sites, and I've highlighted in orange the limitations at those sites. In general, the bulk density at all those sites at a depth of 30 to 45 centimeters or a foot to 18 inches, which is an important rooting depth for trees, is well above a root-limiting bulk density, and look at the pH at the Metapenai site. So, slide to 133 shows another example of a highly compacted wetland soil. I think I've talked about that enough. These are real issues. And compaction, every time we look at a disturbed system anywhere, particularly one that has had any mechanical vehicle traffic on it at all, compaction is going to be a major problem. Slide to 134, and I'll finish here, will take us through a set of recommendations for reconstructing hydric soils on wetland creation sites. First, the subsoil layers need to be ripped. Once you think you're at something approaching the final grade, you need to rip them to a non-limiting bulk density. And again, for a clay subsoil, that's about 1.35. For sand, it's about 1.75. 135 just shows an example of the kind of implement, obviously not working on a wetland site, but chisel plows or other large tillage instruments pulled with appropriate vehicles, which in a wetland site needs to be a four-wheel drive tractor with high flotation tires, can definitely rip both sites. 136 continues with some of these recommendations. If you can save the natural hydric soil and get it back out there, you're always better off. It's got the seed bank, it's got the organic matter. However, a lot of times the site you're creating is at such distance from the site you impact that this isn't practical. You then need to bring in organic matter then as some sort of a supplement, some sort of yard waste compost. The question then is how much? Slide 137 shows one of four different experiments we've done looking at how much organic matter we should add back. It's a classic loading rate experiment. Those high loading rates are actually approaching 150 dry tons of yard waste compost per acre. And the other ones where you see just a little bit of the shading there are lower loading rates. If we look at slide 138, this shows the net effect of adding various rates of yard waste compost on redox. Now, the objective here of lowering redox in a wetland system is to make the soil systems favor hydrophytic vegetation versus upland vegetation. There's two experiments out there. One of them is dry, one of them is wet. Let's just look at the lower one here in red for example. When I just till up the soil a little bit, note that the redox potential drops a lot. That's due to us adding a lot of fresh native organic matter. As I add compost to it at 25 and 50 tons, I keep the redox low. In fact, I drop it a little bit. Note that at the higher loading rates, the redox actually goes back up. And what happens back there is if you look back at the previous slide, you just can't get that much organic matter in the ground, and then when that happens, you actually raise the elevation and get the anti-effect that you want. So one effect in this system of adding organic matter is keeping redox low. While the data aren't shown here, the other dramatic example, or the dramatic effect of adding the organic matter is the bulk water content, or the saturation content, increased dramatically up to 50 dry tons per acre and then plateaued off. So for a number of reasons, again, we're recommending organic amendments incorporated in these sites at anywhere from 25 to 50 dry tons per acre as compost. Finally, 139 adds a few more things to the end. One is when you do bring hydric soil back on, you're going to recompact it, so it probably needs to be ripped again. The other thing we advocate strongly is while you're out there and got a backhoe out there, put some mounds out there. Natural wetlands have hummocks and all kinds of microtopography, and we have another experiment that's posted to our website that has shown conclusively that putting microtopography back on these sites has dramatic effects on cypress growth. And finally, if there's anything else out there that's native woody debris, put it out there. Even if it's logs and stumps, throw it out there. The turtles and other organisms will see definite habitat value from that. Slide 140 shows a picture of some hummocks going back in a cypress recreation site in Florida. There are several states, Florida being one of them, that actually require recreation recreating micro-lithography on these sites. Finally, with this one, 141, I just want to point out that the Norfolk District of the Corps of Engineers has actually adopted the soil reconstruction of procedures as policy guidance, and it's posted. And to my knowledge, I think that this is the only Corps district in the country with these posted, and they do use these criteria as part of permit review. In closing, then, let me say on slide 142, wrapping up all of this two-hour rambling monologue here. First, you got to adequately sample, characterize, and understand what you're dealing with. You got to figure out if it's sulfitic. You got to figure out what its properties are. You got to understand how it got to be what it is. Secondly, your choice of what you're going to do to the site, you really need to know what the site goals are. Are you doing full restoration, or do you simply want to get it revegetated and keep the dust from blowing around? What the end use of the site is will have a huge effect on your choice of options, obviously. Slide 143. Regardless of what else you do, you need to avoid sulfitic materials. If you can't avoid them, you got to run the appropriate test, figure out how much lime they're going to need, not today, not tomorrow, but 5 and 10 years from now, and get that lime into them at least 1 times the acid generation load, if not adding in a comfort factor. More often than not, though, compaction is going to be more of a limitation to you than will be pH. Finally, 144, I've talked about this a number of times, it's just almost remarkable how a combination of an appropriate organic amendment and a liming, when they get together, they work together, and they're really the best treatments we've seen across a wide range of sites. Finally, there are a lot of other residuals out there. They'll be summarized up in detail, both in terms of use availability and application in this EPA white paper. Fly ash and paper mill and sludge are classic examples. What I can tell you, though, is they tend to be highly variable from point to point, and they need to be tested carefully. And that leads me to the final slide and the website link again. And I've pushed the time a bit here, but I will stop now and attempt to answer any final questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dan. Again, I have to congratulate you. I didn't think you'd get through all your material on time, but good job. I guess we're going to open up for the final Q&A section. We have a few minutes. We have a number of questions that came in online during the second portion of your talk, and I'm going to start with those individuals because they submitted them first. For anyone who's on the phone line, while we're going through those questions, feel free to use that question mark button to submit a question right now to try to squeeze it in. And if we have time left over, we'll open up the phone lines and get to questions that way as well. So starting with our first online question, came in from the Army Corps of Engineers in Buffalo, and Teresa asks, can compaction be used to slow subsurface sodium chlorine NaCl intrusion into surface soil layers? Site has been used for salt solution mining. Site is subject to subsidence and small fissures from both subsurface mines and salt solution extrusion. What other treatment is possible?
If you could get and maintain a uniformly compacted layer, yes, you would certainly limit the movement of the sodium chloride. But again, if it's subsiding and it's moving on you, any type of a seal like that is likely to be compromised. High sodium materials, we usually try to renovate with gypsum, but then that just is pushing the sodium further down, so. Short of being able to look at the site specifically, I'm not sure I can offer any more advice on that one.
Okay. The next question is coming from Frankfort, Kentucky, from the company Kenverns Incorporated. They ask, can you discuss liability issues with the use of fly ash as a soil amendment? Many power plant companies are reluctant to have a byproduct applied to the solid for fear of litigation.
Yeah. That's a big one, of course. There was a big National Academy study on that was published 2 years ago. I was actually part of that study. What Virginia, an approach they take, and there is material on this posted to our website, is we'll evaluate materials to be used as a soil amendment individually. We'll make sure the producer can put a label on it and follow that label and guarantee it. And the state, the Virginia Department of Agriculture and the Consumer Services, will actually label it. And then the generator has to stay inside that label. We test it, and then we limit that label based on salts and boron and things like that. I think that's a viable approach. I think as long as you can test the product, as long as the product can stay within acceptable bounds with time, then the key to limiting that liability is to, I think, follow process like that. That being said, if some burp of material, if you wish, were to come through that was higher in some component that wasn't caught, then, you know, I think regardless of all labeling, there probably would still be some liability back to the generator. And those concerns certainly limit the amount of material that goes down on land.
The next question comes in from a consultant in Wilmington, Delaware, and they ask, in your restoration efforts, do you have problems with the control of invasive plant species? If so, do you have some recommendations for control of invasive plant species?
Yes and no. I can say that there are certain species we use on mining sites that work really well that lots of people consider invasives, and I'll leave that one alone. In wetland sites, yes, we do cattail control and things like that. That's not my specialty, but it's certainly an issue. And again, it ties more to the permit target and the post-mining land use. But yes, it's an issue, and yes, we do a wide range of control. No, I don't have any magic bullets for fixes. We are looking right now in wetland systems, though, of the interaction of organic matter and phosphorus on Typha cattail invasion. And we're hoping to figure out a way to actually manipulate Typha invasion based on the actual soil properties within these wetland sites.
Okay, thank you. The next question comes from Argonne National Laboratory, and they ask, what is the approximate size in acres of the Polish sites discussed in the case studies?
The Polish sites, the one site that I showed the most pictures of, that site was about 3 acres in size. There are other pictures posted to our website. That technology has been applied on smelter lands, I believe, up to about 100 acres in size total. On Colway sites, which wasn't pictured, though, there have been hundreds and hundreds of acres of Colway sites revegetated. The implementation of that is interesting in that it got tied up really in some land use control issues. So there has been, it's my understanding, about 100 acres of the slag sites done to date, but I don't think any more than that has been done.
Okay. The next question coming in online comes from, again, another consultant in Wilmington, Delaware, and it says, it appears that organic material stabilized with lime is key to restoring sites, particularly with a carbon-to-nitrogen ratio between 25 to 30 to 1. Is this a fair statement?
Yes. Now, again, that would depend on your target. There, you know, there are some instances where you may not want to put that much organic matter in the system, but in general, the kinds of sites I showed here, wetland sites and coal mining sites and smelter slag sites, we have seen that combination to be a really ideal shot. And yes, the CN ratio needs to be looked at carefully, and that would be an appropriate range of CN ratio.
And the final online question that I have comes from another consultant from Woodbury, New Jersey. And the question is, regarding the wetland restoration, we are involved in a number of wetland restorations in the Pinelands in New Jersey. Do you have recommendations for restoring wetland sites in the Pinelands?
Not specifically. I've been through the Pine Barrens. I would have to really look at the type of a wetland. I was talking specifically about forested wetlands that are basically mineral flat wetlands was the kind of examples I gave. We have looked at a range of wetland sites, and that person might want to contact me separately, and I can talk with them. Like any site, I would need to really look at the site and site conditions.
Okay, and again, that's a reminder to everyone that Lee's contact information is available on that main or start seminar page where you joined the seminar today. But with that, there are no more questions that have been submitted online, so if anyone who's on the phone line has a question, please feel free to unmute your phone lines. You can do that by pressing #6, and feel free to speak up and ask your question.
I have one question. This is Richard up in New York City. When you use a lime, do you use a powdered lime or pelletized lime?
It depends. Usually, it's a question, of application. If you can get the powdered lime down, which is really site access and spreader related, it's fine. The pelletized lime gets a little more flexible, but is obviously more expensive. The pelletized lime you can spread and you can throw with certain spreaders, but we've had fine success with using regular ground ag lime just as long as we can spread it where we want to. Now, there are some other things out there like aero spreaders and some other ways of moving lime and amendments around, or you can slurry it up within a hydroseeder as well, so there is some flexibility. But we have, I'd say, 80% of the sites I've worked with, we've just used regular ground limestone, yeah.
Again, anyone on the phone lines, feel free to speak up and ask a question. Okay, then I guess with that, if there are no more questions that are coming in online and no one else on the phone lines has any more questions, I believe we can consider that a successful delivery of today's event. I would like to thank everyone who joined us today, both on the phones as well as through our simulcast, and thank Lee Daniels from Virginia Tech for his time and materials today. If everyone moves on to slide 46, which is the final slide, there are links that will bring you back to the CLUIN website, and you'll be able to look at additional resources that are available for this topic, as well as a link to our feedback form. And again, I'd highly encourage everyone to take a few minutes to fill that out so that we can continue to improve the quality of the seminars that we offer. Again, thanks everyone, and I hope everyone has a great day.